Brought to you by Bank of America Merrill Lynch. With virtual reality, virtually everything will change. Discover opportunities in a transforming world. BofAML.com/VR. Merrill Lynch, Pierce, Fenner & Smith, Incorporated. Welcome to the Bloomberg Surveillance Podcast. I'm Tom Keene with David Gura. Daily, we bring you insight from the best of economics, finance, investment, and international relations. Find Bloomberg Surveillance on Apple Podcasts, SoundCloud, Bloomberg.com, and of course, on the Bloomberg.
Joining us now from the Bloomberg Invest Summit in New York, Brian Belsky, Chief Investment Strategist at BMO Capital Markets. Great to see you here amid the hustle and bustle of the link, as we call it, the pantry.
So this is what the real people do, right? Run around like
outside
this?
Outside the confines of our radio studio. Brian, let me ask you about how you're regarding what's going to happen tomorrow. It's not a risk event, I suppose. It's three big risk events. How much attention are you paying to what's happening with the ECB, with Capitol Hill, and indeed with the election in the UK tomorrow?
I'd probably say that the ECB is number one with respect to what happens fundamentally, because we've had kind of growth, let's say, volatility in terms of Europe, what's happened from not only an economic earnings but demographic side of things. And things have changed in Europe the last 12 months. So from an investment standpoint, David, I mean, how are we going to position there? And then what does that mean for emerging markets? Because remember, Europe and emerging markets are very tightly correlated. Emerging markets' number one client in Europe. So, I think it's important, especially considering that the U.S. and the U.K. led the revival in equities in the fourth quarter and the beginning of this year. Then Europe played along, and now emerging markets have caught in a bid, so to speak. And so a lot of people are getting excited about emerging markets and what that means. So I think the big thing tomorrow is going to be the ECB. With respect to the noise out of Washington, noise.
How liberating will it be to get through the U.K. election when you look at political risk? Does that stand as a marker to you that you're going to get past it?
Yeah, I think so. You can take a look. It's a great question. You see what happened in France and how the volatility actually. We did not see the big volatility spike post the French election. You know, we had the pre-election and then the real election. So, it's a foregone conclusion that May is going to win. But at the end of the day, again, how many seats did the Conservatives win and retain and things like that? So, and what's the direction with respect to Brexit, and what does that mean for the total Eurozone GDP? So, and then go back to the ECB. I think that's going to be the key thing tomorrow.
You've written that over these last 6 months or so, what we've seen in terms of price returns has been driven by momentum and rhetoric, not by fundamentals and process. How does that complicate things for you as an investor?
It's horrible. It's horrible.
I mean, missing no words here this morning.
No, yeah. I mean, it's literally impossible to be writing about the market every week and try to provide this great, grandiose value add that everybody thinks they're doing, because nothing's really happening. The market's been in this tight trading range the last couple of months, and everybody wants to try to make this big call about what's going to happen on the market. But at the end of the day, we still think it's about buying stocks and being in the right industries and sectors. And I think there's a big contingent of what people that do what we do and investors that just don't get that.
Within this is the mood of investors. Do they feel like they've missed the market? Do they feel like they're in the market? Is there an irrational exuberance?
My team and I were talking about this yesterday. We're getting the sense that more and more investors that we talk to, more and more clients, feel like they need to be in the market than want to be in the market, especially considering the kind of move that we've seen. And I hate to use this word complacency, Tom, but I just think that people are kind of boring themselves to death in terms of owning the same stocks. There's no original thought. And again, I think there's so many binary opinions out there. It's either or. There's nothing in between.
And what we see is on Friday, David, all the gloom comes out.
Right.
I mean, I know you're looking at, kale sales in Brooklyn.
Yeah, okay.
Brian and I are looking at the gloom reports coming out on Friday at 4 p.m. World's going to end, and it makes for a great weekend reading. Brian Belsky with us. We are within our world headquarters. We're not in our studios.
There's sunlight here. Yeah.
There's sunlight.
Yeah.
In Bloomingdale's, off in the distance. Good morning to all of Bloomingdale's. Of course, we're here. Our special coverage, our Bloomberg Invest Conference,
take us through your portfolio right now. What's been doing well? You've had a lot of success with technology. Are you overweight financials as well? What's attractive about financials right
now? Well, you know, we're overweight financials, and we're wrong right now. And I'm not ashamed to say we're wrong because, you know, the bond market's in control of everything. And what we've seen with short rates, you know, the twos and tens, we talked about it on the television program here just recently or the last few minutes. So, you know, we're positioned for the next 12 to 18 months minimum. And over the next 3 to 5 years, we think financials are the best place to be because everyone is so negative, David, and they're not positioned there and they're underweight. We think financials in the way to be. But I think our best call so far this year is to be overweight healthcare. It's been our contrarian call heading into this year. And our theme for healthcare is we buy stocks that keep us alive. You know, so we like the biotechs and the drugs and some in certain big HMOs. But, you know, I think what's going to end up happening is I think the biggest call right now is everybody thinks that growth is scarce and growth outperforms. So we're going to buy the fangs and say the same old crap. And for lack of a better way, I mean, let's have some original thought, man. I mean, let's go out and buy some stocks and own a portfolio and manage a portfolio. So what we've been doing in the real live money that we run for our Canadian investors for the bank up in Canada is that, you know, We run portfolios of 35 to 40 stocks. All four of our products are outperforming our mandate, just principally because market goes down a little bit, we buy more of our favorite names. Market goes up a little bit, we've been peeling back. So we actually, this past month, peeled back a little bit in some of those FANG names, principally because they've had big runs. And we don't think that type of price momentum can continue over the next 3 to 6 months. 12 to 18 months, yes. 3 to 6 months, probably not.
Strikes me that that's so workmanlike. That's so old school. To do the kind of deep sector
analysis. I'm an old
soul,
David. I'm an old soul. I mean, so many of people that do what I do are so focused on the macro, 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 and quant, 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 and nobody knows how to talk about stocks or themes or invest anymore.
Does the public want to talk about stocks, or are they all bundled up in passive funds?
I think they're all bundled up in passive funds. I think, again, more ETF questions from taxi cab drivers and car drivers than we do stocks.
Is that right?
You know, I go back to the 90s when cab drivers were giving us stock picks here in this town, and I think we will get back to that point, but I think still we're more focused on, I mean, the public is more focused on the headlines and the big picture stuff, and that's what's causing all the noise.
You mentioned financials, and I just wonder what you see there. There is all the negativity that you describe. What do you see that others don't?
Well, in the financial side of things, we want to be in those companies, what we call the big box retailers, that have the complete menu, right? So what has been the crown jewel of the financial services industry, the big box retailers, the last 2 to 3 quarters? It's been the capital markets business,
yes.
Right? So we had big trading volumes last year. We had M&A activity. So capital markets done very well. So why have they done very well? Because 2 years ago, we cut costs. So if you look at the big box retailers now, where have they been cutting costs? Wealth management.
Right.
So where's the flows going to come the next several years? Going to be into the wealth management channel.
Okay, Brian Belsky with us, BMO. Very quickly here, and of course, our coverage of Bloomberg Invest Conference on Bloomberg Radio brought to you by SEI, which means we get celebrities that walk by.
Is
they come in at 7:05 a.m. Joining us now, Scarlett Fu, and it's 7:05 a.m. Do you have a question for Mr. Belsky?
Are we talking retailers or are we talking banks? I just walked in and Tom waves me over while I'm eating my banana.
Well, let's talk retailers. That's a good idea.
Scarlett used to get up early in the morning. Now she's a big shot. She just comes in later and it's no big deal.
It is. What about the retailers? Dana Telsey out with a really tepid note on Macy's after their meeting.
So we just published a piece on consumer discretionary. As you know, that consumer discretionary is the most eclectic sector in the U.S. market. Right? Most eclectic sector in the U.S. market. And we had no mention of retailers in that sector in sector note because we're really worried from a secular basis, longer term, what's structurally happening in retail. I mean, clearly Amazon, if you take a look at consumer discretionary sector so far this year, Amazon's 400 basis points, meaning 4 percentage points of the full performance of the sector. If you take that out, consumer discretionary is underperforming.
Okay, we got to go. Brian Belsky, thank you so much. Scarlett, if you lose the Lundquist jersey, wear a National Predators jersey.
What, join the bandwagon? Really?
Yes. David Gurr, we're going to come back with Brian Belsky. David Gurr and Tom Keene, our Bloomberg Invest Summit. For those of you that just got through the CFA exam, we're going to talk Nassim Taleb a little bit and Gaussian and Poisson distributions, which is a good way to get to Brian Belsky of BMO Capital Markets. Taleb, of course, is the mathematics of rare events. by definition, you don't see the rare event coming. What are the set of rare events you're worried about in the equity markets?
Well, I think so many people are laser focused, Tom, on what's happening in Washington. And
so that's not a rare event?
No, it's not a rare
event. Where are they?
Well, the other thing, too, is we just hate this whole notion of black swans. I mean, corrections happen when you least expect them. It seems to us like everyone is still looking for the correction, looking for the correction. When we stop talking about the correction, that's when the correction's going to happen.
The exuberance, and it's not there, is it?
It's not there.
Do you see? I don't see it day to day.
No.
Day to day.
And so it's going to be something that we least expect. I mean, you know, it's not going to be North Korea. It's not going to be something out of Europe. It's not going to be Washington. It's going to be something else. That's all I know.
Two attacks in Iran today?
Maybe.
Maybe. Okay. All right.
No, but seriously, you and I have these recollections. I would respectfully suggest, Brian Belsky, it starts in the bond market where there's a bond transaction that gets left on a Wall Street desk.
Right.
There's some form of short, could be short, five-year convertible, zero coupon bond. Something doesn't work in the savvy bond market, and then that comes over to the equity market.
Yeah, savvy bond market's been right for 35 years now, and so it's something probably in the bond market, but I have not fear, but just trepidation, Tom, that's going to be a liquidity event, right? Some sort of a liquidity event. Is it private equity not happening? Am something not connecting there? So many assets since 2008, 2009 have moved out of the hedge fund world with respect to derivatives into private equity. Is it something in private equity that occurs? I mean, again, I'm just speculating. We're not talking enough about that. So it's either something that we've become so dependent on, Tom, meaning bonds, 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 or something that we're not expecting.
Because of our Bloomberg Invest conference, I'm going to rip up the script here. Brian Belsky, the basic idea of the passive-active debate. Now, you're getting paid to say active. I get that. Where do passive funds fit in?
No, I'm getting paid to be right, Tom. And so...
Yeah, ask them about the Vikings when you get a chance.
That's emotional.
Where do passive funds fit in? Where does buying the index fit in?
Well, I think buying the index fits in when creating credibility and feeling better about buying equities again. It's a process, or as we like to say in Canada, it's a process. So we're gonna buy index funds first. We're going to feel comfortable buying equities, and then we're going to move into something a little bit more quote-unquote sexy that we are interested in. I think investors in general are still worried about stocks. They still think we're the bad guys. They're still worried about corporate America. So if they make a little money in an ETF, whether or not it's a spider or a diamond or whatever, and then they slowly kind of transition back into... Pardon me?
It's like a gateway.
It's a gateway. I'm not going to use the second word of that, but it's a gateway to it.
You've got these 40 stocks in the portfolio. How are you picking them? What are you looking at principally to decide what you're going to invest in at this point?
Well, we start and stop with what we think with respect to the overall market, what our sectors are, and then build it from the bottoms up. So, I mean, you know, we have the very good fortune of knowing a lot of analysts around the street. So we look at how these stocks fit into sectors, and we rush out. We touch base with some of these analysts, but we also use some of our own models in looking at stocks.
I have one final question, if I can. You are Canadian, BMO Capital Markets, Bank of Montreal, and all that. I mean, you've got to look at the fact, once again, there's no Canadian team in the Stanley Cups. This is a national embarrassment. But you got to find solace that Mike Fisher of Peterborough, Ontario, is a Nashville Predator, and he's Mr. Carrie Underwood. That's sort of a good thing,
he's
isn't
Mr.
You know what?
Carrie
it's a
Underwood.
Really good thing on several accounts, Tom. But last year was the embarrassment because no Canadian team made the playoffs. That was a big
deal
Ottawa. Last year.
Yeah. Well, very good. We'll leave it at that. Brian Belsky, thank you for the update with Mr. Carrie Underwood. I got to be honest, folks. Like, you got to root for the Predators. They don't even know in the arena. They're going absolutely mental, like it's football or NASCAR. And some of them are like, you got to go, okay, offsides. That was offsides. It's not like a big deal. Somebody just stepped over the blue line. I mean, it's great. I love it. I love what NBC's doing with it. With Mike Emmerich and Mike Bloomberg.
Do you care about
this, David?
No, I've been following it.
Where's Scarlett Ballmer? Come on, get Scarlett.
We'll get her back here.
We'll talk, you know, hockey. What are we doing, David?
Can we go from the Stanley Cup Finals to the Super Bowl tomorrow in Washington, D.C.? Greg Bellier with a great note yesterday, noting that the sense of weariness settling in. He says, we're sick of this, you're sick of this, and most voters are as well, but a big day tomorrow in Washington.
And he ends his note talking about the vice president, as Dana Milbank did in the Washington
Post. Dana Milbank
in
the Washington Post today, yeah.
I think watching Mr. Pence will be good sport.
Yeah.
David Gurr, the president, tries to get out front of the festivities tomorrow.
Yeah, Tom, you and I stay on top of the president's Twitter feed. Here's a tweet of relevance to our audience this morning. President Trump tweeting, I will be nominating Christopher A. Wray, W-R-A-Y, a man of impeccable credentials, to be the new director of the FBI. The president deciding on him after meeting with him and John Pistol, the former head of the TSA. Let's take a look at some of those impeccable credentials, as the president calls them. He's a graduate of Yale and Yale Law School as well, and perhaps most important for the job he is being nominated for, he was the head of the criminal division at the Federal Bureau of Investigation. So this gets that process underway, something the president was keen to do a couple of weeks ago.
Within a quick read of a lengthy, accomplished biography, I don't see political service. That was with Senator Lieberman and others of Connecticut. That was one of the issues, is do we want someone with a political heritage? And I believe we see less of that, if not none of that, with Mr. Wray.
Yeah, he's now a partner at King & Spalding, the big law firm. As I said, head of the criminal division. And in that capacity, according to his official bio, he led investigations, prosecutions, and policy development in nearly all areas of federal criminal law. So we will continue to follow this news throughout the morning. And we'll watch as the White House formally tenders that nomination.
And again, our coverage tomorrow, David Gurr, David Westin, and Kevin Cirilli will be tomorrow in Washington for the 10 a.m. Comey coverage. Right now, after all that, we try to get back to what we do each and every day with economics, finance, investment, with Charles Dumas of T.S. Lombard. Charles, you are as qualified as anyone in the world for the important question of where is our nominal GDP, where is that combination of economic growth and price elevation? Have you brought down your nominal GDP belief in the last number of days?
Yeah, the wage data you had in the United States yesterday morning for total hourly compensation were extraordinarily changed from the same number a month before. A month ago, they said the first quarter was up 3.9% in terms of hourly pay. And yesterday morning, they said, actually, no, the first quarter was only up 2.3%, which is like a huge reduction. And so we have to assume here that nominal GDP will be weaker. But we don't think that real GDP is going to be inhibited by this. We just think that inflation will be less.
This is a really important dynamic, folks. And again, there's four ways to go here, both up, both down, or a mixture. Either way, do the central banks in any way think nominal GDP, even if they won't admit it?
Well, to be quite honest, I'm not probably the right person to talk to about how central banks think. We try to figure out what they're going to have to think ahead of time. And in this case, we think that probably Mrs. Yellen will want to get the funds rate up to something that roughly matches inflation, which means, about three more hikes this year. And be ready in case there is an inflationary pickup next year, which I'm bound to say looks more likely than not.
Charles, you've been advocating for a long time here for a plan B when it comes to Brexit, for the UK exiting the European Union. I don't know if we're any closer to getting that or if we will be after the election results tomorrow, but what would you want to see in that? What would a plan B look like? What's your ideal plan B?
Well, I mean, I don't think anything's ideal here, neither plan A nor plan B. The main point about plan B is simply that it should exist, because at the moment, the British are being told by the EU people, the EU negotiators, that actually they have no option but to pay large sums of money and in order to get free trade. Now, it may well be that we should pay substantial sums of money to get free trade, it may well be that's how it ends up, but the bargaining position is substantially weaker until such time as it's clear that we can survive and do okay if there is no agreement.
What's this economy look like that the next prime minister is going to inherit? Be that Ms. May, be that Mr. Corbyn. What's the UK economy look like? What are the biggest deficits in that economy as you see them?
Well, the biggest risk by far, it seems to me, is that if we don't have a well-conducted negotiating process about Brexit, then you're going to see suddenly a confidence problem in the financial markets and in the business sector. And people starting to say, well, look, this really doesn't look like a well-managed exit, and so we're going to get out first. At the moment, people are assuming the worst. in making their business plans, but they don't actually have to fix their plans till the end of the year. So the government's got about 6 months to articulate, first of all, what it's really looking for, and obviously that's a negotiating position vis-a-vis the EU, but also what happens if the negotiations don't work or break down, in which case we've got to get by on our own. And it's a perfectly feasible thing to do, but there needs to be a detailed and convincing plan.
Charles, you have a number of books on China. They have been remarkably prescient about everybody get over the doom and gloom and fear. Is China as resilient as when you wrote those books a few years ago?
Well, we were fairly negative about China when we wrote those books, and I think it's fair to say that some of that negative feeling has become the consensus. At this stage, I would say that China is going to be fine, at least until the other side of the big Congress this autumn. And in fact, in all probability, they are going to modify their target growth rate from the 6.5% they have at the moment to something much more achievable, like 4 or 5%, and thereby give themselves a decent chance of curbing the rapid increase of debt, yeah, which has been going on until recently. So that's really the crucial issue, is how they plan the trade-off, because they can't at the same time have fast growth and a relatively high exchange rate and curb the debt growth. So if they want to curb the debt growth, they've either got to have slower growth or a big devaluation. And we know they don't want a big devaluation, so chances are they're going to have to go for a distinctly lower growth target. Now, that doesn't mean that they're in trouble. It just means that they've got to face up to reality.
Charles Dumont, thank you so much for the briefing. He is with T.S. Lombard in London. Brought to you by Bank of America Merrill Lynch. With virtual reality, virtually everything will change. Discover opportunities in a transforming world. BofAML.com/VR. Merrill Lynch, Pierce, Fenner & Smith, Incorporated. William Gross is with us, which is often, and he's been generous at Janice Henderson of being with us for Jobs Day and such, but it is wonderful to have Bill Gross in our New York headquarters today. He's here for the Bloomberg Invest Conference, and that's brought to you by SEI, but we thank Bill Gross for being with us. Did you come by Greyhound bus? You don't like to fly, do you?
Well, I don't like to fly. I'm a white knuckler. Actually, yeah. I was an early Navy pilot that bailed out, so to speak, and I took the Greyhound bus. I didn't go as far as that famous football commentator that takes the bus.
John Madden.
The time. But I creep slowly along.
We should say Bloomberg Surveillance today brought to you by Janice Henderson and Greyhound Bus. They see each other often. Bill, when the last time I saw you in New York, I believe, was a long time ago. We met at the Waldorf Astoria in the middle of an ugly bond bear market. I believe that's where prices go down and yields go higher. You and the rest of the world wait and wait and wait for a bond bear market. When will we see that?
Well, that's the question of the day and the year and the last several years, actually. We'll see it, I think, when central banks start to ease up in terms of their current policies, not only quantitative easing by the ECB and by the Bank of Japan, but more tightening by the Fed and less reinvestment of treasuries.
Well, that's the key question. Jan Hatzius at Goldman Sachs is now linked tightly those two, as does Robert Kaplan at the Dallas Fed. How do you link yield changes by the Federal Open Market Committee with the balance sheet adjustments to come? How do you put those two disparate flows together?
Yeah, it's very hard to do that, and of course for the Fed as well. I know that Fed research, since they instigated quantitative easing, suggested that 75 basis points on the 10-year was the ultimate result. Now, the exit, or the potential exit, which I've always been disparaging of, and the possibility that they really reduce their balance sheet, but if they begin to exit later in the year, they'll do it slowly. And so we're talking about 5, 10, 15 basis points on the curve in the 10-year, perhaps over the next year or two. You know, the important central banks I consider are the Bank of Japan and the ECB, and to the extent that they're pumping in $1 trillion plus a year into the global economy and global liquidity, it's been critical in terms of treasury rates, and it's been critical in terms of stock prices, and critical in terms of all assets, because liquidity seeks a haven, and prices move higher as it does.
We have Bloomberg News reporting this morning the ECB is going to cut its inflation outlook at the meeting this week. We're talking about what unwinding the balance sheet is going to look like. What's your timetable for that happening, do you think? When do you think we're going to get to a more normal role for central banks?
Well, I hope later in the year for the ECB. And it's true that the ECB's primary focus, as opposed to a dual or a tri-focus on the part of the Fed, is inflation. And inflation has not really picked up in the last few months, certainly in Euroland. And so you can imagine that Draghi is simply not concerned and wants to err on the side of caution. Perhaps later this year. I know, or I don't know, but I think, as you know, I've been quite negative in terms of the effects of central bank policies, not simply because they've raised asset prices in some cases to bubble territory, but also because it degrades business models such as insurance companies and pension funds and the like, because they can't earn what they're supposed to earn in terms of their liabilities. And we begin to see that with Puerto Rico and Illinois and Detroit and ongoing problems with pension funds. But it's the same situation with insurance companies. It's sort of masked as we move on in the future.
Get the sense that 3% growth is this administration's white whale, and they talk about it so much, maybe they're willing it to happen here. When you look at the tools at their disposal and what they're doing, are they using the right ones? Are they going down the right path to get to that level of growth, do you think?
Well, not yet. I mean, the proposals, I suppose, on fiscal policy, which is something that I've been asking for and others for several years, even with Obama, are certainly in the works. I'm suspicious of tax policy, but $1 trillion infrastructure policy may help. But I think ultimately the growth is a function of productivity, and productivity is a function of investment, and we simply haven't had that. Mm. You know, my thesis this month in terms of the investment outlook is that, money is making money with money, but money doesn't lead to investment in the real economy. And I think that's the problem that Trump and the U.S. economy will face over the next several years.
Bill Gross with Janus Henderson. He's with us now at our Bloomberg Invest Conference on Bloomberg Radio, of course, brought to you by SEI. Bill, I just looked up. If you really book now, $235 Greyhound, L.A. to New York, you can get it back. If you delay a little bit with Bloomberg Television, it may cost you $271. When you came here, you went out North Platte through Des Moines, and then you got up to I-80 and you take it over east. When you do this, Bill, you get a sense of the nation, and you've been dead right about the nation's financial repression. Don't talk to the fancy people in Newport. Don't talk to the fancy people like us in New York. Talk to the rest of America about financial repression.
Well, you're right, and Des Moines has been my favorite metaphorical
location. Why do you use
location.
Them?
Well, because it's in Iowa, and because it's Midwest, and because there's corn there, and because...
wrestlers, you know, too.
because people depend on savings, ultimately, not just in Des Moines, but the rest of the country. And why do people depend on savings? Well, for education, for retirement, for health. Mm. And when you can't earn more than 50 basis points on your savings in a bank account or with a six-month CD, then there are problems aplenty in terms of the ability of Des Moines and other middle-class Americans to reach their goals.
I mean, I look at this bill and what you and I have been talking about since that meeting at the Waldorf Astoria, and certainly since August of 07, is it's not in Fibonacci. It's not in the books that you and I studied on bond dynamics. How do you do Janus Henderson day after day after day, realizing none of where we are now has a theory or a foundation?
Well, it's sort of a Braille-like type of process where you feel your way along, and central banks are trying to do that too. But you're right. When you talk about demographics and debt and leveraging up, and when you talk about the displacement of workers by robots and robotization, these are non-measurable factors historically. And so you sort of have to touch and feel and know that over time, these factors will work their way into a slower economy in the U.S. and even globally.
You were talking about infrastructure just a moment ago. The president wants to get more private investment in infrastructure. What are the challenges to doing that? How does he make that successful, getting more public-private partnerships, getting more private investors to invest in American infrastructure?
Well, there's a political problem. That's not my area of expertise, yeah. But you're right. Trump's emphasis has been on public-private, and I think there are a lot of willing private partners. A lot of private equity firms have geared up to take advantage to make money from infrastructure problems. And so, you know, if right. you combine that with congressional action, then I think you have something to go with. But the $1 trillion is over a long period of time. It takes time to put these into effect, and so it may take a while.
Very quickly, Bill, does the drama of Washington diminish GDP and dampen the animal spirit of the nation?
Yeah, I think so. To the extent that risk is a factor in terms of forward-looking investment, hope is really the essence of capitalism, yeah. and to the extent that you have turmoil mm-hmm. in Washington and turmoil on a global basis, right. I think that's a problem.
Bill Gross, thank you so much. Thanks. I've got it from, thank you, Greyhound, for emailing me. 2 days, 17 hours, 30 minutes is your fastest trip back. Bill Gross is with Janice Anderson. From our Bloomberg Invest Conference, this is Bloomberg. David Gurr and Tom Keene, our Bloomberg Invest Conference. And after the CFA exam and the level of mathiness of it, it's a good time to speak with Jim McCaughan of the Principal Group. I want to talk a little bit of math here, in that if you got a curve on a chart, you go to logs to make the curve a straight line.
Yep.
And then all years of my radar go up when the log chart becomes curved as well.
Is this when I hear you yell slope matters?
Slope matters. Okay. And then all of a sudden, instead of a straight logarithmic line, you've got a curved line. I've got that now in the 2s-10 spread. I've got curve flattening, and I have accelerating curve flattening. What does that mean to Principal Group? What does it mean to equity investors when they see an acceleration of curve flattening?
Curve flattening is a sign that you're getting towards the end of a good spell for the economy. You're getting to the end of a recovery. Mm-hmm. It means it's a straw in the wind that there may be a recession out there. I don't think the other indicators point to a recession within the next 2 to 3 years, right. but it's one of the reasons you have to watch.
If the vector's going to zero to an inverted yield curve, we don't need to do it on radio. People drive off the Garden State Parkway. But where's the tip point where all of a sudden you say to yourself, I'm at 85 basis points. It's like a countdown, folks, the Ranger satellite to the moon. 85, 75. 65. When do you start sweating? Or do you get to go to inversion?
I think you start sweating when it gets totally flat.
And, to zero.
Yeah. And I think that that's when you really have the imminent signs of recession. Now, the most likely outturn on the Fed funds rate right now is maybe 2 25 basis point increases this year and maybe 2 more next year. That would get you to somewhere about 175 on the Fed funds rate. I don't see that that means that the 10-year would be anything very different from 210 to 220, which is what it is now. I think what you're seeing is late-stage growth in the economy, which gets accommodated in interest rate terms by yield curve flattening. So I think this is actually pretty normal at this stage of the economy. We need to be a bit on recession watch as we go into 2018. I don't think it's imminent, however.
We have a two-day Fed meeting next week, and it's likely, or one would hope we'd get some more indication here of how the balance sheet unwind is going to go. What are you most worried about in the context of that? What's the riskiest facet of that to you?
Yeah, David, I'm not at all worried about the balance sheet unwind. You know, the build-up of the Fed balance sheet was, you know, 2008, 9, 10, and it was done by a maximum of 10-year bonds. Those are going to start rolling off next year.
Just naturally, yeah.
Just naturally. I don't think they need to sell much in the market. So the unwind doesn't really bother me. I think we're at a point where the economy has self-sustaining growth, though not particularly vibrant. And that's an okay position to be in, because it's when the economy overheats that you bring about capacity constraints and a recession. So I feel fairly positive about the next year or so for equities.
The OECD was out today with its new economic outlook, and it was a fairly rosy picture, rosier than one might have thought, perhaps. But one of the things the OECD flags is the need for more global participation. And I wonder, in light of what we've seen here over the last week, 2 weeks, with the president's trip to Europe, with the U.S. withdrawing from the Paris Accord, what that portends for the kind of participatory global economy we've become accustomed to?
Well, there's no question that this administration in the U.S. wants to see bilateral, not multilateral deals. Let's hope they get the bilaterals done, because to your point about participation, it would still happen in a bilateral world. So I'm not yet in any kind of panic about that. On the OECD numbers, the two things I would question. Europe, is Europe as self-sustaining a recovery as it looks? The positive signs from Germany, I think, are largely a result of last year's weakness in the euro. I think it remains to be seen whether the core eurozone can carry on growing in spite of getting to a point where the euro is a bit stronger. So that would be one of my questions. The other is China.
Yeah.
Will China continue growing at the rate they expect?
Is there exuberance out there? Is there institutional exuberance? Is there retail exuberance?
Not really, Tom. I think this is the bull market nobody loves.
It just can't end because there's not a blow-off. There's not a capitulation.
There isn't. And you know, if I look at equities, what will end the bull market? Well, I think you have to get to a point where everybody's in, or most people are in. And to me, that feels like 25 times earnings, not 18. If, you know, 2 and change is the 10-year yield, 18 times earnings feels fairly cheap to me. I think U.S. equities remain a buy on setbacks.
Jim, just because you were going to show up, I had an extra hat trick of Walker's shortbread.
That was the reason why. Yeah.
Cookies, thank you.
Pure butter.
Make me feel at home.
For you in Scotland, we would be rude if we did not ask you how snappy election's going to be. We can't talk about it tomorrow. So we're going to do it now. What does it mean for Scotland, please?
For Scotland, I think it's an interesting question. I'm hoping that the Scots don't go for another independence referendum. I think Theresa May, if she's reasonably powerful after tomorrow, will probably try to postpone and deny that. Because I think once you've got a big change like Brexit going on, to have the disentangling of Scotland would be very, very disruptive. I'd also point out, Brexit won in a referendum by about 3%. Remain, in the case of Scotland, won by over 10. A 10% win looks pretty decisive. It seems very early to go re-examining it. So I think for Scotland, this probably plays out as a bit of a non-event, but a rather ill-natured one.
How heavily does this interregnum, this two-year waiting period for action on Brexit, weigh on the UK economy?
Well, I think it's not weighed very much because it's been saved by the weakness of sterling. The weakness of sterling is what's meant that the economic impact has not yet been negative. I think there is the likelihood, if there is a serious impairment of trade relations with the eurozone, which, you know, looks likely, all the talk is of a hard Brexit, no deal or a difficult deal. If that's the case, then you either need further weakness in sterling or you will see a pretty seriously impaired UK economy 2 years out. I think this is one of the tail risks in the world economy right now.
Chimikov, thanks so much. Greatly appreciated with Principal Group today. From our Bloomberg Invest Summit, thank you so much.
Come back.
I love how he shows up every time as a UK election. There's been a lot of them recently.
Yeah, that's coincidence, Tom.
In all seriousness, he's on a panel later this morning here with Julia Chatterley, our colleague, on populism, policy, and positioning, the macro view. So we look forward to that on Bloomberg Television and Bloomberg Radio.
It is a Bloomberg Invest conference from our world headquarters on Bloomberg Radio. Thanks for listening to the Bloomberg Surveillance Podcast. Subscribe and listen to interviews on Apple Podcasts, SoundCloud, or whichever podcast platform you prefer. I'm on Twitter at Tom Keene. David Gura is at David Gura. Before the podcast, you can always catch us worldwide on Bloomberg Radio. Brought to you by Bank of America Merrill Lynch. With virtual reality, virtually everything will change. Discover opportunities in a transforming world. BofAML.com/VR. Merrill Lynch, Pierce, Fenner & Smith, Incorporated.